Mitt Romney won enough delegates in yesterday's Texas primary to officially capture the GOP nomination for president. But his moment was overshadowed by, guess who? Donald Trump. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's Politics Day here on the program. We'll talk about what Romney's win in Texas means and about the role of Donald Trump, who hosted a fundraising event for Romney last night in Las Vegas. Plenty of other political developments on the landscape to discuss with our analysts this week. Dennis Goldford of Drake University, Bruce Gronbeck of the University of Iowa. Does Donald Trump do the Romney campaign more harm or more good? Join our discussion. Politics Day here on River to River starts right after this news.
Eastern Daylight Time, 13 hours.
This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and it's Politics Wednesday here on the program. Glad to have with us for Politics Wednesday, Bruce Gronbeck, Professor Emeritus of Communication Studies at the University of Iowa, joining us by phone. Good afternoon to you, Bruce.
And good afternoon. It's a beautiful day in Colorado.
It is a beautiful day in Iowa as well. Dennis Goldford with us, undoubtedly to attest that it's a beautiful day in Des Moines, where he is in our studio. Professor of Politics at Drake University. Dennis, welcome.
Hey, I'm locked in a studio with no windows, so I'll have to take your word for it.
Right. For the next hour, we are windowless, but not clueless. For sure not, with Bruce and Dennis. So we'll be talking politics. If you'd like to join our conversation on any of the topics we touch on, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org, our email. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Well, Mitt Romney won enough delegates in yesterday's Texas primary to officially capture the GOP nomination for president, but his moment was overshadowed by Donald Trump, who hosted a fundraising event for Romney last night in Las Vegas. Trump, who has endorsed Romney, was interviewed on CNBC about the differences between Romney and Obama's economic plans. But then the question of the president's birthplace was raised, and Trump said this.
Now, is it the most important thing? In a way it is, because, you know, you're not allowed to be president if you're not born in the country. But let's see what happens. So I'm not fanning flames. This is something that came out last week. A lot of people are questioning his birth certificate. They're questioning the authenticity of his birth certificate. I've been known as being a very smart guy for a long time. I don't consider myself birther or not birther, but there are some major questions here, and the press doesn't want to cover it. The press just refuses to cover it. Now, if that were somebody else, they would be covering it and they'd be throwing people out of office, but they don't want to cover it. So it's interesting.
Romney has repeatedly said he believes the president was born in the U.S., and he distanced himself from the comments by Donald Trump by saying he doesn't agree on every issue with everyone who supports his candidacy. Well, these statements will likely fade from memory unless Trump forms his own super PAC, something he has said. Also said on the CNBC interview that he is planning to do, perhaps throwing in as much as $5 to $10 million into the race. Dennis Goldford, how much influence could Donald Trump, is he having on this race, also looking forward?
Well, Romney needs to be able to say to Donald Trump, you're fired. And he just doesn't seem to be able to say that. Trump is a distraction. Romney will have no trouble whatsoever raising a ton of money to be competitive with the Obama campaign. You know, there's that old phrase, keep your enemies close and your friends closer. And this supposed friend in Donald Trump really, I think, hurts the Romney campaign because it associates it with a perspective that while some people hold it, most conventional politicians and others think it's a fringe issue where Republicans want to focus on the economy.
Mm-hmm. Your view on it, Bruce, does it hurt the Romney campaign more than it helps?
Well, I think what hurt the Romney campaign in that issue is not Donald Trump. He's flying his own satellite somewhere in an alternative universe. But and Wolf Blitzer said it. That sounds ridiculous. And of course, Trump replied, "I think you sound ridiculous." I mean, so he's just flying around. But Romney did something that he's been prone to do, which is to start backpedaling. I mean, he went and, you know, and said, "I think he's entitled to his opinion, and I don't agree with all of my constituents. And as long as we can agree 50.1% of the time, I can go forward." And you know, that does not cast a lot of credibility for him with and the group he keeps trying to, to pull hard on the conservative wing in hopes that he can get them to actually come out in November and vote for him. It's that kind of floating down the middle on a raft that's not too solid that I think is just going to dog him this entire campaign, unless he can do precisely what Dennis said and just stiffen up.
Why go
after people like Trump, not publicly but privately, and say, "Look, I've got to run my campaign, and if you hurt me, we're going nowhere."
Dennis Goldford, explain to us what Mitt Romney sees in Donald Trump that is so valued that he would play this middle of the road game.
Well, it's hard to see what he sees in Trump. I mean, George Will made that point on one of the talk shows on Sunday morning that he doesn't need Romney for the money. And I think that you know, there's a divide on the in terms of the base, the conservative base of the party, and this is the fringe of the conservative base, the birther types. You know, they think there's this tremendous conservative majority out there in the country, and all you got to do is be sufficiently religiously, dedicatedly conservative, and that's all you need to win an election. But and there's a mirror image on the Democratic side thinking there's this big liberal base out in the country, liberal majority. But in actual fact, what the Romney strategists have tended to argue, and I think they're right, is that the election is going to be won or lost, as typically it is in American presidential politics, in the middle. And Romney's courting of Trump doesn't help him there, but Romney's always had this sort of, I guess, insecurity feeling with regard to the willingness of the base to turn out for him. But I think they're so antagonistic toward President Obama that they're going to show up. That's not a worry. He just needs them not to damage the brand with suburban soccer moms.
Interesting footnote on this. In this context, the Romney campaign released his birth certificate. His mother, born in Utah. His father, of course, former Michigan governor, one-time Republican presidential candidate George Romney, was born in Mexico. So on the day when Donald Trump is trying to help Mitt Romney stir up a new round of questions about whether Barack Obama was born in the U.S., Romney's own birth record became a reminder that in the 1968 presidential campaign, his father would have faced his own birther controversy. Isn't that true?
Well, he was born of American citizens, so... It was in Mexico, and for those of you that want a background,
well, the same
family,
would be true of President Obama. We know, and it's not disputed, right, that at least one of his parents is an American.
Right.
Yeah.
So yeah, but you know, the whole thing with his father is, I said, is in, handled very nicely this week in Newsweek magazine, by the way, to give them a little plug. And the family stuff is really an interesting part of that background. Yeah,
Bruce, let me ask you, how important is it for a campaign, this campaign, to be able to control the messaging?
Well, he's going to have to do it. I mean, I think Iowa is just a very good example from this last month. I just heard this actually on NPR last night that last month in Des Moines there were about 250 ads played for both Obama and Romney, and just a little over half of Obama's ads were paid for by his campaign, and the rest by outside money and by the super PACs. But in Romney's case, he did not pay for a single ad. He was not controlling a single message going into into central Iowa last month. And that may make him feel good about getting all that good pressure and having especially all those negative ads flying around. But sooner or later, and Dennis is right, he's going to have to go after the middle. If you think of the country as roughly one-third Republican, one-third Democrat, and one-third independent, so far as voting is concerned, and that's not exactly it, but it's close enough, he's got to go after that middle third. And the way he's letting his message being controlled right now, he's going to have trouble as we get into fall.
The Obama campaign has released a series of ads, while we're on the topic, longer videos highlighting Romney's record with the private equity firm Bain Capital. Here's an excerpt from a video that talks with Kansas City steelworkers about a less than positive experience with Bain when the company took ownership of their plant.
I was a steelworker for 30 years. When I first started working, I looked around. We had 5,500 employees. It was like a city inside of a city.
Steel would always be needed in the United States, so it sounded like a guaranteed job.
We were much more than just co-workers. We became very good friends.
We made parts for automotives. We made parts for nuclear plants. We made jail bars.
We had a reputation for quality products. It was something that was American-made, and we weren't rich, but I was able to put my daughter through college.
Having a good paying job that you can support and raise a family on is hugely important.
That stopped with the sale of the plant to Bain Capital.
Bain Capital was the majority owner. They hired the management, they picked the board of directors, they were responsible. Mitt Romney was deeply involved in the influence that he exercised over these companies.
Now, the Obama campaign has called Romney's record at Bain fair game in an election focused on economic issues. Romney has called the ads character assassination. An Obama campaign surrogate, Newark Mayor Cory Booker, was asked about the video and the ads on Meet the Press, and here's what he had to say.
This kind of stuff is nauseating to me on both sides. It's nauseating to the American public. Enough is enough. Stop attacking private equity. Stop attacking Jeremiah Wright. This stuff has got to stop, because what it does is it undermines to me what this country should be focused on. It's a distraction from the real issues. It's either going to be a small campaign about this crap, or it's going to be a big campaign, in my opinion, about the issues that American public cares about.
Booker's comments about the Reverend Jeremiah Wright to relate to the fact that the Romney campaign was able to convince a high-profile donor not to fund ads highlighting the association between the pastor and Obama and some of Wright's controversial statements about race. So the Obama campaign has had some difficulties of its own with surrogates. Booker went on to release a video saying that he fully supports Obama, was expressing merely frustration with the negativity of campaigns, not with the president. Dennis, is Booker fundamentally right in his statement that the campaign will be about little attacks being launched by the two campaigns, not big ideas?
Well, they'll attack each other with every particular weapon they can find, whether it's a rock or whether it's rhetorically nuclear, so to speak. But I think you have to remember, with regard to Bain, that this is not to say that the Obama campaign is using the issue effectively or well, but I think it's legitimate, because Governor Romney has run away from his record as governor of Massachusetts. He's not running on the basis of his experience as having been a governor. He's running on the basis of the claim that because of his work for Bain, he knows how the economy works. He knows how jobs are created. That's the basis of his campaign and his economic message. So it's entirely legitimate and smart for the Obama people to go after that, but they have to do it the right way. Now, what Romney did for Bain was entirely legitimate. There's no question of illegality or lack of ethics or anything like that there. But what the Romney people have tried to claim, and I think the Obama people are trying to get to, is that at Bain, his job, so to speak, was to create jobs. That was not what Bain is all about, or was all about, at least under Romney. His job was to make a profit for investors. Now, if they could do so by creating jobs, they would create jobs. But if they could do so by cutting and slashing jobs, they would do that, because jobs themselves weren't the focus of what he did at Bain. It was making a profit for those investors. So that's his basis for his claim that he's qualified to lead the country in tough economic times, and that's why the Obama campaign is going after that.
Dennis Goldford of Drake University with us this hour. Bruce Cronbeck of the University of Iowa. Politics Wednesday here on River to River. We'd like you to join our conversation as we progress through a number of aspects of the political landscape. currently, and perhaps you, a River to River listener, would like to share with us what you think of ads that you've been seeing lately in this political campaign. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Our email, you can tweet us at IPR Talk. You are focused on political messaging. Bruce Gronbeck joining us by telephone. Tell us about the focus on Bain by Obama and the messaging going on there.
I'm glad you played a clip of that ad. I actually watched it yesterday. It's about, it's not exactly an ad, right? It's about 9 minutes, so he's not going to be playing it a lot of places. It's put out by his so-called truth team, and they're stacking those things up. What that, if anybody actually watches that all the way through, they will finally understand how Bain Capital, as a essentially an investment group and not a normal kind of corporation, was doing its work. It does a good job, I thought, of pretty clearly saying, here's why Bain Capital's moves were hard on corporations like GST Steel, which is the subject of that one out of Kansas City. It does a good job of saying, all right, how they're able to draw money out of the company and use it then for profits for the investors and then for people in the leadership roles of Bain Capital. It's complicated for most of us who really don't understand investment stuff very well. And yet I agree with Dennis that if that mechanism of Bain Capital gets to be understood, it will, in fact, I think, cause Romney some grief and reinforce something that was being talked about in that Newsweek article about his family that I mentioned, where one of his dad's workers and strong staff member said, George Romney had leadership skills. Mitt Romney has management skills, which is a damning comment to come out of family friends. But I think that theme will begin to grow. If the Obama campaign does what it has done a couple times last week, which is go to pretty extreme bloodletting metaphors talking about Romney's work, it's just going to be a distraction. But if they can actually focus the idea, I think it may do them some good because, again, as Dennis said, it's going to say this wasn't about jobs at all, right? This was about making the 1% richer. That will be tough for Romney because it's just feeding into a whole series of other things, down to his Cadillacs and how he gets cars up and down in his garage, floating through the electorate.
Okay, we've got about 5 minutes before we have to take a short break. Let's make sure we get in a caller before the break. Adrian is with us from Des Moines. Are you with us, Adrian?
I am.
Yes, please tell us what's on your mind.
Just one quick comment. I agree with Mayor Booker. I think that the campaign should focus on this large issue, and that is, in light of what's going on in Spain or Greece or California, does Keynesian economics actually work? And I think that's the dividing line. And I'll shut up and listen.
Okay, who wants to jump on Adrian's comment there with Keynesian economics? Dennis?
Well, that's a huge topic. It's the idea, of course, that when you have a downturn in demand, government should in fact run a deficit in order to stimulate consumer spending. And once that picks up again, then the government starts to run a surplus, if possible, to recover that. The argument in Europe is that you've got to go to austerity and shrink government spending. The counter argument is that was what was done in the 1930s here and threw us back into another second round of the Depression. So economists on both sides argue this time and time again. But in a sense, people say, well, under President Reagan, we didn't do Keynesian economics, but President Reagan created a kind of military Keynesianism, massive increases in the spending in the defense budget, and that can be entirely legitimate, but the point was it was government spending. And, the difficulty is that if I lose my job, I don't go to your restaurant Therefore, you have fewer customers. You may have to shut down. You fire people. Therefore, they can't go to the hardware store and buy things, so the hardware store has to shut down. So it keeps spiraling down. Mm-hmm. And the idea of this Keynesian stimulus is that you try to put money in people's hands so they'll start spending, which increases jobs, which increases tax revenues, and overcomes that deficit. That's the theory.
When we look across the Atlantic, we don't have to look back to the 1930s. We look across the Atlantic with countries supposedly united entity dealing with the economic downturn. And that will be interpreted two different ways as well, Dennis?
Oh, yeah. But, I mean, you have to remember that in many ways, Germany is a living refutation of Republican economics. And I don't say that as a Democrat or a liberal or anything like that. But, you know, Germans have strong welfare state safety nets in place. And these are all the things that people here, Republicans here, will say destroy the economy. Germany still has one of the strongest economies in the world. So they're not all like Greece.
A quick word before we had to take a break, perhaps on other happenings in Texas besides Mitt Romney clinching the GOP nomination with delegates in the Texas primary yesterday, a boiling primary battle in Texas heading to a runoff as two Republicans running for the U.S. Senate failed to reach the 50% threshold to clinch that GOP nomination. Lieutenant Governor David Dewhurst led the crowded field of candidates, narrowly failed, though, to cross the 50% mark required to secure that nomination and avoid a July 31st runoff. Dewhurst's challenger in the runoff, Tea Party favorite Ted Cruz, former Solicitor General, with strong support from national groups, high-profile conservative leaders. What does this tell us about the Tea Party in Texas? Bruce, have you had your eye on this one as well?
Yeah, I did, because, of course, one of the reasons Dewhurst didn't cross the 50%, he got 48. He came darn close. Was we had a good pro football player, Craig James, running against him, who picked up enough votes probably to stop him. There were four in the race. The two got 78%, so the focus was there. Dewhurst spent an amazing $31.5 million putting all the money together, both his and the outside, into that race, with strong endorsements from people like Huckabee, of course, Governor Perry, since he'd worked with Governor Perry for 10 years. So he had everything going, and he still couldn't push it over. So there's still in Texas, it seems to me, enough strength on that more conservative end, and certainly the Tea Party group, because he also, you know, in terms of Cruz, he had, of course, the Texas Tea Party group, helping him an awful lot. And he had outside money from Freedom Works and Club for Growth and Crossroads and that usual array. The main thing you draw out of Texas, and it really is being commented a lot already today, is how much outside money is flowing in. And race after race after race, and state after state after state, now is being strongly affected, or so we assume, strongly affected by that flow of outside money coming in. We're just going to be watching Wisconsin next Tuesday to see if that happens again. That, it seems to me, is still the big message. The big message this year all over the country is the message of money from the super PACs that are stirring themselves into state politics. All politics is not local in this year.
Okay, Bruce Gronbeck, Dennis Goldford, we have to take a break, and thank you for mentioning Wisconsin, Bruce. We'll talk about that when we come back. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker poised to survive next week's vote on his recall if our polls are to be believed. We'll talk about that when we come back. Also, other things on your mind, we'll talk about Iowa's congressional races, also the GOP primaries in the congressional races here in Iowa. That's when we come back, and we'd enjoy having your comment, your question in the second half hour of River to River today, 1-866-780-9100, River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Back in just a few minutes. River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, halfway through, midstream, so to speak, in River to River on Politics Wednesday with Dennis Goldford of Drake University, Bruce Gronbeck of the University of Iowa. And first few minutes, we wanted to dedicate our discussion to the recall vote next week in Wisconsin. If you want to weigh in on this, we know we have some Wisconsin listeners in our neighbor state, 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker poised to survive next week's vote on his recall, if we are to believe the polls. Dennis Goldford, what can you tell us about the way the situation looks now for each side?
Well, you know, to pick up on what Bruce was talking about with regard to outside money, Walker has raised a lot more money than the recall supporters have raised. And the figure I just saw yesterday, in fact, was that 60% of the Walker money, in fact, is from out of state, outside of Wisconsin. So there is this huge amount of conservative money sloshing around the country, freed up by the Citizens United decision, that's going into various kinds of races of highly symbolic value, for example, this particular case. That'd be quite a scalp to hang on the wall if Democrats were able to turn out Governor Walker, and it would be quite a trophy if they were able to maintain him in office and maintain their momentum. But again, as in all electoral politics, it all comes down to turnout, and the question is whether, in fact, the Democrats can get the turnout they need.
Okay, let's go to Jerry, who wants to weigh in on this issue. Jerry calling from Shell Rock. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was in Wisconsin last week and did an informal poll among several of my relatives. A bunch of them are public school teachers out in the southwestern part of the state, and they all admitted that Governor Walker had hurt them very badly, and during the big ruckus this winter, they swore they would vote against him. Now they're going to vote for him because they remembered they are Republicans, and so is he. Another relative and retiree and county worker in Milwaukee, who is actually part of a class action suit against the county over revoked retirement benefits when Scott Walker was county executive of Milwaukee County. As I say, my relative is suing the former chief executive on that, but he's going to vote for Scott Walker on Tuesday because he remembered he's a Republican and so is Scott Walker. So I think party loyalty is going to win out on this.
Interesting. Jerry calling from Shell Rock with an account of what people he's talked to in Wisconsin are now thinking. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Bruce, react to what Jerry said, or what else do you want to make a point about in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I think Walker has been beating the drum that his actions about you know, vis-a-vis the unions was not anti-union. It was just sound fiscal policy, and that feeds into all of those school teachers and relatives who have been conservative in their outlook, have been Republicans if not conservative, and are going back to hang on to that party rather than turn loose a guy who already lost once to Walker. I think Walker has managed to recover out after all that swirl, heady talk about being able to recall a governor. And of course, this is happening once more to the south of Wisconsin, down in Louisiana. Jindal has now a campaign to recall him, getting cranked up and getting ready to get on the ballot, even as if we're to believe the first signs. So it's something that has been tried successfully. I think this is right only once before at a state level. It's awfully hard to pull back a vote that you gave that put somebody into office, unless there is amazingly deep kinds of scandal, and none of the scandal as hard as the Democrats have scandalous items that the Democrats have tried to use in terms of lying to congressional committees and so on is sticking to Walker at all.
When we look at Wisconsin, what it means for national politics, don't we have to ask the question though: in what ways does the discussion going on in Wisconsin differ from the national political discussion? How much of a match is there, Dennis Goldford?
It's really about that classic question about the role of government and the belief that government on the part of substantial numbers of people, that at least in the abstract, they believe government is too big in terms of number of employees, it's too meddlesome in terms of what it does, and it spends too much. The problem is that if you start to ask people in particular, not sort of general ideas like that, but do they favor particular programs? Oh, yeah, they certainly are in favor of things like Medicare and certainly in favor of things like Social Security. So there's a disjunction for people. They are, so to speak, ideologically more conservative. Oh, yeah, government's too big, tries to do too much. But they're programmatically more liberal. Oh, yes, we like unemployment insurance. Yes, we like Medicare. We like Social Security and so forth. But there has been a sustained assault on the underpinnings of the New Deal system of governance and the so-called welfare state that reaches back to the 1930s. And much of what we're seeing now with the Tea Party and Ron Paul and people like that is a reach back to that early opposition to the welfare state as it developed under the New Deal.
Dennis Goldford with us of Drake University, Bruce Gronbeck of the University of Iowa. Turn a little bit of our focus to Iowa after Wisconsin. Governor Terry Branstad, not surprisingly, making appearances, criticizing President Obama. The focus of that criticism primarily has been Obama's handling of the economy. However, he's also been promoting his own record as governor and the progress he's making on a campaign pledge to create 200,000 jobs in his first term. Here is Branstad on Iowa Public Television's Iowa Press Program, May 18th, talking about his record of job creation.
So I'm feeling really good, not only about the number of jobs, but the quality of the jobs. The new job creation since I've been governor is 6 times the pace it was in the previous 12 years. Am I satisfied? No. I work at this every day, and we're going to continue to work aggressively to bring more business and jobs to the state.
So, Bruce Gronbeck, if he's selling a message for himself of job creation and a good state economy, can he also send this message that the nation's economy is so bad we need to defeat the sitting president?
Well, they both want to take credit for those jobs, of course, because they tend to be in some areas that the federal government as well has been pushing for increased growth. It's very hard, it seems to me, sitting in Iowa to argue that the push for growth in new jobs especially belongs to one party or the other right now. And given that Iowa's unemployment rate's 3 points below the national average and everything else, I think that's a difficult argument to be peddling. I think Branstad certainly can work the positive side of that argument very, very well. And he certainly is, that he's been doing what he promised to do. It's in trying to use that as a saber to go after Obama that makes it sound, if not ridiculous, at least kind of contradictory. And I don't. I think he can find other grounds to serve his party as this campaign runs on. I mean, Iowa certainly isn't obviously in the thick of it as a very important swing state right now. The candidates seem to be comfortable being there, spending money there. They like that very much, I think. And so Branstad is certainly going to be able to be playing a loud role in this campaign. I think he's probably going to be better off with his positive with a positive message. But at least on this kind of issue, on the growth issue.
Dennis Goldford, the president, we hear, always gets blamed whether the economy is bad or praised when it's good. What about a governor like Terry Branstad? Does he get credit for jobs creators in the minds of voters?
Well, ask Chet Culver. I mean, you do get credit after a certain point or blame. You know, you bought it, you own it. Once you're in office a certain amount of time, it's yours, whether in fact you have any actual meaningful impact or not. But I think a governor oftentimes has more meaningful impact on a state economy than sometimes a president has on the national economy. The controversy right now, at least a tempest in a teapot perhaps, is when the governor promised to create 200,000 new jobs. And, you know, that's odd to hear a Republican say, because they'll say politicians don't create jobs, private business creates jobs. But in any case, he talked about, I believe it was creating 200,000 new jobs. And I think most people assume that was a net addition to the number of people employed in the state. And lately we've been hearing, no, that's just new jobs, even if other jobs are continuing to go away. And so you know, the net may well be way short of 200,000. You might create 200,000 new ones, but if you lose 150,000, how much better off are you? You can fill up a bucket as much as you want, but if there's a hole at the bottom of the bucket, it's not doing you much good to keep pouring water into it.
Dennis
Goldfield. This is going to be a real troublesome, I think, issue in that sense. Obama's ads, of course, are saying that he created 4.5 million jobs already, and he's going strong, and he's hammering on that. But again, that is not a net gain. That is the number created, and you're not subtracting the number lost. And both at the state and the national level, with governmental jobs continuing to fall in number, and unemployment rising to in at various levels of government, it is going to be very hard to be able to look at what is the actual gain in number of people employed in the country.
Isn't that interesting? Governmental jobs falling, they're not counted. Do they fit into the rhetoric anywhere?
Well, everybody avoids it, right?
Well, why does each side avoid it?
Because Obama, let's say the president says, okay, I want to be a good Keynesian, and therefore I'm going to use public money to create more. He's already gotten hammered, gets hammered constantly, of course, for the bailouts of the economic institutions, of the auto industry, for what, and Romney right now is going after him for money he put into entrepreneurship. Wasn't an awful lot of money, but he's put money there. And we get Solyndra comes running on all those ads. It is very hard if you're afraid of being accused of big government spending to hammer too much on that issue of public employment as part of the equation. This is not Roosevelt in the 30s. We're in a very different kind of atmosphere right now, as Dennis was saying. You've got to work that private side as much as you can, and that's really tough if anybody starts pushing on both the governor and the president.
So, Dennis Goldfield, when a politician loses government jobs in his district, he doesn't get the blame for it in this era.
Well, certainly not from Republicans. I mean, Republicans get the best of both worlds. They can criticize a politician for the unemployment rate still being relatively high or higher than it should be, and at the same time they can praise certainly a Republican governor for lessening the number of government jobs, because from a conservative standpoint, there's nothing productive about a government job. It's very different from having a job at General Motors or at Bain Capital or anything like that.
Let's go quickly to a couple of congressional races in the state, actually GOP primaries to face two incumbents before our hour ends. Iowa District 1, the GOP primary coming up next week, to two contenders there to face Representative Bruce Braley, Democrat. We have the two Republicans, Ben Lang, a 33-year-old attorney from Independence, narrowly losing to Braley in 2010. Rod Blum, a 57-year-old businessman from Dubuque. Bruce, do you want to give us your read on that? What's outside money coming in? A lot of messaging there.
Sure it is. I guess I'd say that Lang, from the looks of the first signs I've seen, and again, I'm kind of pretty far away, seems to have learned some good things last time through. I think he got a little smarter. He's not going to simply say that he is really conservative and committed to a series of conservative principles, but I think he's already starting to swing his hammer harder on some key economic issues. Bloom is to me, at least as an outsider, and kind of an enigma here. He's running against Obamacare and in particular the insurance issue that has been affecting in the news at the Catholic Church, among other in their institutions, among other people. Unless he gets a broader base than that, he also says he's a lot older. I think he's in trouble, and I think Lang will probably pick up that election and give Braley a good run.
Okay, Rod Blum versus Ben Lang. How do you see it, Dennis Goldfield?
Well, I think Lang certainly has name recognition from having run before. Even if unsuccessfully, he didn't lose by much, and it's always tough to overcome name recognition. The standard Republican arguments among themselves, at least since the rise of the Tea Party, have been either One candidate will say, I'm more electable, I'm more able to defeat that Democrat than you are. Or the other kind of argument is, I'm more conservative than you are. And so that's how Republican primaries, not just in Iowa but nationwide, tend to be fought out right now. But I think Bruce is right. Blum is going to have to struggle against the advantages that Lange has. But as I've said before, it all comes down to turnout.
Let's pivot down to District 2 in Iowa. Dave Loebsack, the Democratic incumbent, challenged actually in a Democratic primary by State Senator Joe Tseng. Is that really a challenge, Dennis?
Well, yeah. I mean, lightning can always strike. But I believe I saw a figure this morning that in various congressional primaries around the country so far, something like unless you have a primary where two people have been thrown into the same district, 98% of incumbents have survived primary challenges.
Okay, let's look at the GOP challengers primary between John Archer, Dan Dolan, both Southeast Iowa businessmen. What can we say about them and that matchup? Dennis.
I have to say I'm not familiar.
Okay, yeah. Not familiar. Bruce, anything on that one?
I mean, both are running from, again, the little I've seen, running very similar campaigns, and since I certainly don't know either one of them. Mm-hmm. I'm not getting any sense that at this point there's a clear dividing line that voters are going to be able to use to make their electoral decisions.
Well, perhaps we can end this program with your thoughts on a bit of audio I'm going to play from the man who delivers audio, as we say, better than most politicians, at least whatever political party you belong to. He's fun to listen to. On Sunday, former Senator Alan Simpson, Republican of Wyoming, lashed out at members of his party, slamming them for their unwillingness to compromise on proposed tax increases. In his characteristically colorful style, Simpson said on CNN that Republicans' rigid opposition to new tax revenues has hampered productivity, diminished the chances of reaching an agreement with Democrats on debt reduction. Here's what he had to say.
Well, I think my party and I have different views on a lot of things. I guess I'm known as a rhino now, which means a Republican in name only, because I guess of social views, perhaps. Or be common sense would be another one which seems to escape members of our party. Abortion is a horrible thing, but for heaven's sakes, a deeply intimate and personal decision, and men legislators shouldn't even vote on it. Gay, lesbian issues, we're all human beings, we're all God's children, what is this? And for heaven's sakes, you have Grover Norquist wandering the earth in his white robes, saying that if you raise taxes one penny, he'll defeat you. He can't murder you. He can't burn your house. The only thing he can do to you as an elected official is defeat you for re-election. And if that means more to you than your country when we need patriots to come out in a situation when we're in extremity, you shouldn't even be in Congress.
Former Senator, Republican Alan Simpson. Dennis Goldford, Alan Simpson, a key figure once upon a time in the GOP. Can we say he's now on the fringe?
Well, he is in today's Republican Party. What's happened to the Republican Party since the legislative defeats in 2006 and the legislative and presidential defeat in 2008 is that the party has lurched even more to in a conservative direction than it has in the past. In some ways, Ronald Reagan would be not conservative enough for today's Republican Party, despite the way they mythologize and idealize him. There are two wings of the Republican Party now, conservative and ultra-conservative, and that's where the fight tends to go on within the party.
We've got a couple minutes left. Bruce Gronbeck, let me reach out to you. Any issues that we are not paying attention to, haven't mentioned this hour, that we should be, that are on your radar?
Well, the only one that seems to be affecting Iowa is Minnesota's fight over gay marriage, because they keep blaming Iowa. They point to Iowa and say, look what can happen if we don't get this constitutional amendment through. That's for me one of the interesting national issues, because you're going to have a series of states, Maine, Minnesota, Maryland, and Washington, that are all going to have initiatives up in their November election. And then you just begin to put this in the context of Obama's comments and Biden's comments and the Supreme Court decision that's going to roll through sometime. I expect it'll depend on whether it goes back to the state for another run before they take it on.
This, and
all of this floating in a time when just over half of the citizens in most polls across the country are generally in favor of it. That is just this sooner or later in almost every big election year, one of the hot button issues kind of floats up and becomes important. This is the one now, and it'll come it seems to me as a kind of deflection, as you've already been hearing in a lot of corners, from what the so-called real issues are.
Bruce, I want to give Dennis a chance in the last 30 seconds to chime in on this or another thing. Bruce,
All we see with the atmospherics about the economy and the presidential race in Iowa, don't lose sight of the Iowa Senate. Perhaps even more than the presidential race, that's what's important to Iowa Republicans, so they can take control and put through that constitutional amendment to ban same-sex marriage.
Okay, Dennis Goldford of Drake University, Bruce Grinebeck of the University of Iowa. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining us for this hour of Politics Wednesday on River to River.
It's always
good
a pleasure.
River to River is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan. Technical support from Dennis Reese in Des Moines. Help from John Pemble. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. Our theme music was written and performed by the River Monks. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. You can contact us anytime. RiverToRiver@iowapublicradio.org is our email. Of course, we have podcasts, on-demand audio of our programs, all of them to be found at iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.